Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome.
So I chose a passage from some of the oldest Buddhist writings that we have. They're called the Nikayas. The particular one I'd like to talk about this morning is the name of it in Pali is Bhaddhakaratta. And you will have to forgive me if my pronunciation of Pali is not exact. It has several different translations, and I think when you hear them, you will be surprised at their variety. So one is One Fortunate Attachment. That's one. Another is One Auspicious Night. Another is The Ideal Lover of Solitude. And the last one by Thich Nhat Hanh is A Better Way to Live Alone. So, there's quite a variety there, I think. So, but I think for the purposes of today, we won't kind of get into dissecting how those various translations came about. However, I think I'd like to talk a little bit about Thich Nhat Hanh's translation. He actually wrote a little book about this sutra. It's very small, just 50 pages or so. And the reason why he goes into quite length about the title, of which I'm just going to say a few things. But there's another sutra in the Pali canon that says very close to the same thing that this sutra is going to say. And it was directed toward a person who may have misunderstood what the Buddha taught, Siddhartha Gautama taught, when he said things like, go sit in the forest and go to a quiet place and sit down and cultivate solitude, things like that. Well, this person, we can always, whenever we say one thing, we can always take that thing a little too far. And so, very often this is what Zen teaching is about. We say something kind of striking, like, there's no self, or something like that. And then we might misinterpret that a little bit. But because it's a very basic teaching, because it represents something opposite than the way we are normally thinking about reality and things. So they say something that's completely outside of our normal way of thinking, because we think, well, here I am, you know. It's obvious. I'm in this place and here I am. That's what we normally think. So when someone in Zen Buddhism says, like, there's no self, you know, and you think, well, what do you mean by that? And so we might start to really get into that kind of thinking, what does that mean? And then all of a sudden start believing, oh, there's no self. I don't have any self. And we might kind of carry that to some kind of degree. Well, then the Zen teacher will say, oh, wait just a minute now. You do have a kind of a self that you have to take care of. And you have to respect that thing. But it's in a little different way than just thinking it's a solid, concrete entity that's always existing here, never changing. So the same with the Buddha. He said, please cultivate solitude and go and quiet your mind down. Well, why would he say such a thing? Because usually we don't do that. Usually we're living in a very busy life, always trying to do things and get things, and that's our usual way. So he says, do something different than that. than the usual way. But then some people sometimes misinterpret that, and they say, well, I'm going to go just live by myself and not have any contact with people. So anyway, that's what one of his monks did. Just completely kind of divorced himself from all other relationships and went and lived by himself. Well, some of the other monks started thinking, oh, something's a little off about this character. You know, he's weird. That's usually what happens in Buddha's time, you know. Sometimes we don't think, 2,500 years ago when Siddhartha Gautama was alive and Buddha was alive, everything was probably really beautiful and wonderful in most times. But it's not exactly true. There were lots of problems in the community. And so one of them was this person who kept kind of going off by himself and wouldn't have anything to do with anybody else. And some of the monks came to the Buddha and basically said, we think you need to talk to this person about, you know, that teaching. And so the Buddha said, okay, please go get him and tell him to come here and I have to talk to him. So anyway, he gave this teaching to that person. He said, it is obvious that you like the practice of living alone. I do not want to deny that. But I want to tell you there is another wonderful way to be alone. It is the way of deep observation to see that the past no longer exists and the future has not yet come. And to dwell at ease in the present moment, free from desire. When a person lives in this way, the person has no hesitation in the heart and gives up all anxieties and regrets, lets go of all desires and cuts the fetters which bind the person from being free. This is called the better way to be alone. So that was the teaching. And so now we'll go to this sutra, and this is why Thich Nhat Hanh, you'll see when we actually study the sutra, the similarity between that teaching and what's said in this sutra. This is another sutra in the canon that occurs, and this is why Thich Nhat Hanh made the connection between these two sutras. So this is how this... Now I'll go to the sutra itself. So it begins this way. It says, thus I have heard on one occasion, this translation calls the Buddha the Blessed One, but I'm going to call him just Gautama, just by his name. Thus have I heard on one occasion Gautama was living in the Jetagurus, Nathapindika's park. There he addressed the monks and nuns. They responded, Venerable Sir, they replied. Monks and nuns, I shall teach you the summary and exposition of one who has one fortunate attachment. Now that's the title that this translator used for that same sutra I'm talking about. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, sir. And Gautama said this. Well, first I'm going to stop for just a second, and it occurred to me, while I was listening to a tape of another person give a talk. And he began his talk by saying, if I just might have your attention, please, for a little bit. That's how he began his talk. And I kind of thought about that for a little bit. And then I went and read this. And this is essentially a kind of formula by which almost all the sutras begin. So almost always you'll find this little thing, listen, attend carefully to what I shall say. And I thought, that's kind of an odd thing to say. I mean, I never thought about it before. But we can sense, like, that means this person who's going to speak to you feels like they have something important to say. And they're going to ask you, please quiet your mind down, listen carefully, and attend to what I say. And I thought, wouldn't that be wonderful if I could say that every time I got up to speak? But we don't have so much confidence that I have to say, you know, okay, settle yourselves down, pay attention closely to what I'm going to say. I don't have much confidence. But I thought, well, maybe someday I will. I'll keep trying. So this is what he said. He said, let a person, not a person, revive the past, or on the future build hopes. For the past has been left behind, and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let the person see each presently arisen state. Let the person know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come, who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep it and the hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is that person, the peaceful sage has said, who has one fortunate attachment. So that's this stanza. When I first read this, maybe 30 or some years ago, I was quite taken by the modernity of it all. You know, we say these days, be here now, or something like that. And it seems to me that this is saying something quite similar 2,500 years ago. It doesn't say exactly be here now. It says, but it hints at something. So we resonate with these words, be here now. There's only one, there's a kind of a problem though with it, with be here now. In that, if we examine that closely, we can't find here. There's not a place that's existing called here. And we can't find a time called now, no matter how closely we look. So how do we actually go there and be there? It sounds like a wonderful idea. It sounds like if we could get to this place that's here and now, there would be this kind of wonderful place where we could always be, and it would be safe and secure, and we'd be happy. But the problem is here and now is slippery, and it's always changing. So there's no particular state that's here and now. However, the words point to something. They point to an activity, something we can do that shows us a way by which we can relieve some of the anxiety and stress that we experience in our lives. And so, but these words themselves strike me very deeply because I don't think I'm totally unique to this situation, but at least in my younger days, and actually I even notice it even now, how much we kind of go back to the past and revive it, to find a sense of joy or happiness or just sort of some kind of ease. And of course, I read this when I was very young, and I didn't quite understand it then. But they, I think it was in psychology when I was like class, when I was like 18. They said young people, generally speaking, look ahead to the future for their, happiness. When I'm done with school, or when I get through this test, or something like that, or when I get married, or when I have a family. So old people look back. And I really noticed that now in my life. When I was young, I really looking forward to something else than where I was. In the future, things got to be better than this. And now I don't look forward to the future very much anymore, because I think it's just going to get worse. But then I also read something that interesting, I think, in that same class, where they said, we're studying the stages of life. And I think of maybe Erik Erikson or something. But anyway, the thing that I remember reading is they said, the second most difficult period of your life is adolescence. And I was an adolescent when I read that. And I thought, oh my God, there's another adolescence course? This is the second worst? But I was really miserable. I was miserable all the time. Nothing could make me happy. Too much. I remember one of my teachers, I was walking around on the campus, kind of just moping along. And we had a park right next. It's a small little school I first went, and he could see out his window. He just watched me kind of moping. This is when I'm 18 and something, 19. I'm just always bent over, walking, nothing. I never could be happy for very long. And anyway, we were having a private discussion once, and he just sort of said, I looked at you walking around. I was reminded of myself when I was a student. But anyway, so this second, I studied this second worst period of your life is adolescence, and then the next sentence said, the hardest is old age. And at that time, I didn't think much about it. I was 19. I thought, well, okay. That I don't think it's going to... I don't think so. But as we get a little older, it becomes clear. We have our greatest challenges as we age. And we see everything change into impermanence. Everything we've loved and deeply cared for and tried to get just sort of fades, starts fading away. And then so we have to deal with that. And hopefully, maybe we've done a little practicing about looking at that before we actually get there and it like slugs us in the face really hard. But even so, we get slugged in the face and stomach every now and then in our lives. Particularly, when we lose someone we love. That's what does it the most. Our parents or... I don't have children, but that's a real... That's probably the hardest thing a human being can do when they lose their child. I think the hardest thing they can deal with in this life. We don't have to look too far to see that. These days we have really good health care, so, but even 50 or 100 years ago, families were like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 kids because probably a couple of them aren't going to make it past you, and you want to kind of make sure something goes on in your life. My grandma had 11, and three of her kids died before her. My mother had three, and one of them died before her. So you don't have to go too far. Sorry, man. So, but what this sutra says that's just a little bit different from be here now is instead, with insight, let the person see each presently arisen state. So, it's already something that's happened, the arisen state. We don't know what happens next at any moment. We don't know what's next. But we can attune ourselves to just what it is we're experiencing right now. And really, this is about the only thing we can do. Now, it doesn't mean that we can't make plans for the future. It also means that we don't learn things from the past. We have to attend to that. And we have to attend to our future. I'm the director, so to speak, of a little practice community in southeastern Minnesota, and we're a non-profit organization, just like the Milwaukee Zen Center is. And so we have, when I was thinking of this, not long ago we had a board meeting, and you all have board meetings too, and we have to plan things for the future. And we start, and we get kind of excited about it, and it's interesting. But very soon we can notice that we start to get agitated with each other around the plane. You know, in a board meeting, start to get, like, not fun to go to. So it's a very interesting process. And I've been, on boards for years and years and years, so I realize that being a board member is really hard practice on a nonprofit organization. So sometimes we're always looking for new board members, And someone will mention a name, and I say, I don't think so. They don't want them to get burnt out. It's like someone new has got lots of energy, and they said, yeah, I'll just give them a little time to settle in and enjoy the practice before put them on a board. So, anyway, but the reason I'm suggesting that, or why I'm bringing this up, is because what happens when we have those kind of meetings where we start planning for the future, we start to get kind of agitated around it. And we forget, like, what's happening right in our group, the presently arising state, and the anxiety we're experiencing. And sometimes we just have to come back to that as a practice and just be there with it, know it. Sometimes we can address it directly, say, I'm really noticing we're kind of getting anxious, why don't we just take some time out and take a few breaths and come back to the conversation, something like that. But sometimes we can't even be, that direct, because people start getting, how many times you bring that, going to have to bring that up. Get agitated about that. So we have to speak kind of carefully to bring us, how we bring things back together and do something to plan for the future, yet still pay attention to this place where we actually are with each other. So then the Shakyamuni offers a little more explanation about this. It says, how, monks and nuns, does one revive the past? Thinking, I had such material form in the past, one finds delight in that. Thinking, I had such feeling, such perception, such formations, such consciousness, one finds delight in that. That is how one revives the past. And how does one not revive the past? Thinking, I had such material form, feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness, one does not find delight in that. That is how one does not revive the past. And how does one build up hope upon the future? Thinking, I may have such material form in the future. Thinking, I may have such feeling, perception, formation, and consciousness in the future. One finds delight in that. So, I think we can relate to that somewhat. In my own case, I started really... I've always had a fairly athletic body. You know, that just came to me, and I was a wrestler, and I didn't have to work hard, you know, to I was agile and all that. And, for about the first 40 years. I didn't have to work at it. Well, then things started to change in my physical constitution. And so quite recently, I've really gotten serious about physical exercise. And not only just aerobic and strength, but stretching. You know, I have to do. And so this kind of thing of thinking, I had such material form in the past. And think, oh yeah, wow, I remember. And then thinking, may I have such material form in the future? Well, after I really get back into you know, I'm going to get back to where I was. And I find delight in thinking such a thing. The other situation, too, that brings this up is I've always loved traveling in my life. In recent years, it's been almost every year that I go someplace a little exotic, like Laos or Thailand or Indonesia. Before that, it was Latin America somewhere. Trying to get a little bit off, you know, where people don't go so much. My last trip, I was a little bit off where people don't go so much. You know, so there's not all the tourist kind of facilities available. And it was hard hearing things, you know. I'm thinking, you know, when I'm in my 30s, I did all these really things that people don't do so much, you know. And I thought, I'm really glad I did them, because there would be no possibility that I could do it now, physically. So then he gives one last admonition in this sutra, and he says, how is one vanquished in regard to presently arisen states? One regards material form as self, or self as possessed of material form, or material form in self. Regards feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness in the same way. And how, bhikkhus, is one invincible in regard to presently arisen states? One does not regard material form as self, feeling, perceptions, formations, consciousness, as self, or self as possessed of consciousness, or consciousness as in self, or self as in consciousness. It's sort of an interesting combination here. He says he doesn't regard... what he's using here is called in Buddhist psychology five skandhas. Five skandhas means five aggregates. And it's just a way of taking this being here, this whole being, and kind of dividing it up into parts. Ones like the body. The body, this thing has a formation, this thing called dokkha or whatever, you know, there's a body here, you know, I can feel it. And so that's one of them. Because if someone, or if I does something to the body, hits it, or it gets burnt or something, you know, I go, whoa, wait a minute, that's my job. Don't mess with my body. It's here. So that's a big part of us, our body. Another is our feelings. We have feelings. That's a big part of us. And we feel... In Buddhism, there's basically just three feelings. Unpleasant, pleasant, and neither pleasant nor pleasant. That's a feeling. I'll go back to that in a second. And then there's formations. And that's kind of out of these... just basic feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Formations come up. Formations are things like anger, jealousy, greed, joy, love. Those are all formations. They're a little more complicated than just feelings. We don't quite think that way in Western psychology, but that's how Buddhism is. So feelings and formations, all these formations that are arising, and then consciousness. So those are our five things that are just part of ourself. And they're arbitrary divisions, but they're just, he's just saying, break this down, what's here. Look at those five things as part of what you really think you are. When he says, like, the body's not me or mine, but he always asks his monk, what do you think, if you had that or owned that, would it ever change? And they said, no, it wouldn't. But do you see a body that's not changing in yourself? I said, no, I don't see it. So how can you say it's yours? That's the point. If we actually owned something like this, we would have it. It would be ours. And it wouldn't change. But we don't, because we don't own it or have it for ourselves, it changes without you know, us in control. So that's why there's nothing permanent or concrete in these things called our body, feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness that can be called our own. So that's one side. And of course the other side is we can't deny that they're there. We want to watch that we don't get into denial, because that's another thing that human beings can do. We can deny, I'm not angry. I'm not angry. Anger isn't inside of me. It can happen. So I'll just go back to feelings for a second, because that's kind of interesting. When they just have these three, pleasant, unpleasant, neither pleasant, not pleasant. So if we look at ourselves quite closely and intimately about just what's happening as we go through our lives and through all the various manifestations of everything that can happen. And we think, as human beings, we have this very strong belief that we have the most sophisticated operating system of any other organism on this earth. Don't we? Yes. We're human beings. We think our operating system as human beings is the most sophisticated operating system than any other organism. We believe we're at the top of the evolutionary place. But if we examine what we're doing moment by moment, if you examine it real closely, it's just pleasant, unpleasant, pleasant, unpleasant. But really, you can look, you can see it's pleasant, pleasant. It's just on and off. And sometimes there's a middle there, and we get sometimes so tired of just, it's either pleasant or unpleasant, that we just want it to be nothing. Nothing. So we just want to turn on the TV, sit back, popcorn, and just keep nothing happening. No, nothing coming in, nothing. Because it's kind of too much, you know. So, and really, if you look at, you know, these moments of pleasant, I mean, it's so subtle. You know, just look at when like a person's coming towards you. What's happening? You're going pleasant, unpleasant. Looking at their face, you know, and saying, oh, they look angry, it's unpleasant. They're going to come at me, you know, they've got something on their mind. This isn't good. So, that's unpleasant. But what we're doing in Buddhism is noticing those things. We're noticing that that's going on. Because usually it's all going on without our awareness. And without awareness, then there's only a limited degree by which we can function. Really, truly function. And be receptive to the world. Because if we're not aware, that unpleasant thing comes up, what do?
Avert.
Aversion. I can't think of thinking of something kind of like robotic or something. This way. See, something in play, like, huh? Change direction. Because we don't want to experience that unpleasant thing. It looks like it's coming toward us. And the opposite with pleasant. You know, oh, this is, yeah, pleasant. So we go toward it. We go toward it. Well, in Buddhism, we're trying to really watch this thing that's going toward, which means grasping, kind of trying to get it. It's like building your hope up on something. It's like this. And the aversion is just wanting to get away from something. Mm. So actually, that's what we do in Zazen, too. Just in this very simple act of sitting down and looking at the wall, we can see moment by moment how we're doing that. We're constantly sometimes chasing after something. You know, we're thinking something, I say, oh, right, that sounds really good. Oh, well, yeah, right. And then we just kind of keep the story going, oh, yeah, well, So that's a kind of a chasing. We're kind of entertaining ourselves. It's kind of like playing a movie. And we kind of enjoy the movie because we're the director and change it however we want to make it soothing, you know. So that's one thing we can do in Zazen. Of course, the other thing is when things actually start, they're arising and they just don't feel good. They don't feel good at all. That can happen during Zazen. Anybody here for the first time?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah.
So we don't. So also, when we don't actually teach that, you know, in introduction to Zazen, yeah, that things can be bad.
Sneak up on
that. So you're advanced students, all right? Because you know, the general thing about meditation is, yeah, it's gonna calm you down, and you're gonna not experience as much stress in your life. Maybe your blood pressure will drop, you know, things like that. Well, I can speak from personal experience. Sometimes your blood pressure goes up. In any event, the point isn't actually. It's just to be present with these things that are arising. This is why you sing. Just be, what did you say? Know what's presently rising. That is to say that perhaps you might have had some encounter a week ago or a few days ago or years ago with someone that was very unpleasant. And what did we do at that time? It was so unpleasant, we averted. You know, it's like, oh, I'm not going to deal with this. You know? And it might have happened just yesterday with somebody, you know, or it might have been years ago. It might have been yesterday with just a coworker, or it might have been years ago with a parent or something, whatever. But we avert it, and until we actually experience that deep unpleasantness and actually the pain associated with it, it'll always be there in our life. So what happens is when we sit down and begin to just be quiet here, that is to say, we start noticing when we're actually creating these scenarios or these little movies. And we say, oh yeah, that's another movie, you know, going on. And I realize I'm doing it, so I'm gonna make the decision to not play it right now. I'm just gonna turn the switch, turn it off for the time being. And we come back and we just, you know, do breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, and we're saying, this is really getting boring, you know. After a while, it's okay, but I could use a little more stimulation. So we start thinking about something. And we say, oh yes, doing that again. Yes, okay, I'm going to stop. When we do that, something changes inside. We start to quiet. There's some quietude we can experience that we don't normally experience. Upon experiencing that quietude, something might come up from deeper in our life that we are not aware of. It might be from 20 years ago, some significant thing with some significant person that was painful or joyful, doesn't matter. But it might arise. And then we'll actually feel, oh my God, whoa, that hurt when that happened. But we've kind of closed ourselves off from that. Or it might have been yesterday with a coworker who just said something and he just went, okay. We weren't actually there experiencing. And then that comes up in our mind. Ah, jeez, that made me mad. We didn't even know we were angry at that. But then when we sit down, you know, we can feel that anger or something. And we just let ourselves experience it. We don't actually chase after it and try to make it bigger and bigger. We just experience it as it's arising. Then we might think, why am I doing this meditation? Anyway, when I sat down, I was feeling okay, and now I'm all upset. What's the point of this? However, after we sit there for a while and actually experience some all that unpleasantness, and then we get up and wonder why we did it, but when we get up, we feel something different. We experience our lives differently. Because the function of these unpleasant things, or anger is a good one because it's so unpleasant. is just to feel it, just to experience it. Once we experience it, it's gone. So I think, kind of, why don't we save a little time for you to bring something up now? I think we're scheduled to end here about in 5 minutes or something like that. Five,
we
10 minutes.
We can go on. We can go on if we want.
You know, so. No. So, anything come to mind?
I have a question.
Hmm?
With the skandhas, intellectually I can understand that I'm not formation, I'm not feeling, and so forth. But when it comes to consciousness, it's hard to understand, it's hard for me to understand that I'm not consciousness.
I think...
I'm aware that consciousness is there.
Mm-hmm.
But is that awareness of consciousness, is that also consciousness?
Yeah. That's, for instance, we often say, like, well, who's the person doing zazen?
Yeah.
Anyway. What's, for instance, sometimes we, let's just say, we sit down and we actually experience some kind of a degree of peace or something quiet. Let's just say that we haven't experienced before. Let's just say that happens. It might take a long time, but it can. And then we'll say, well, who's experiencing this? Anyway. Well, behind that, there's just nothing. That's just that whose experience is just something else that's arising, a kind of a consciousness coming up again, based on those conditions. In Buddhism, there is this one formation. It's kind of interesting. It's called continuity of self. It's a kind of a psychological thing, of which we believe, there's a very strong belief in this formation called continuity of self. For instance, something really believes that I've been continuing along. Yesterday I was over there, and I just continued. And now I'm here, and I'm continuing along, going this way and that way and every which way, but there's something there that's just absolutely always continuing along. It's just a formation. It's one of the consciousnesses that's very deeply rooted in our being, continuity of self.
There's a real devotion to that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is. And I think it's, it's actually beneath our consciousness. There's a certain consciousness here that I have, here I am, but there's something beneath even what I'm consciousness of a continuity of self going. We can notice it, I think. For instance, when I live out in the country, and many animals, are crossing the road all the time when I'm driving. And so, I'm driving along, thinking about something, or I'm doing my little voice exercises with the radio, with my CD, for my snoring. And then all of a sudden a deer pops up. It's like it just changes everything. It changes the whole world. And I believe, I've been driving along here, I was, and now here I am. But it's like all that was happening is just these changing conditions are coming up. And when the deer pops up, I believe I've always been here, right, in this place. But I haven't been. I've been, sometimes I haven't even known I'm here. I'm just doing something, and I don't even know I'm there. In fact, that's most of the time. You don't know you're even where you are, in a certain kind of way. But then, every now and then, you get this idea, here I am. And you think you've always been there. You've always been here. But all that's really happening is just continuous change. with our bodies, with these kind of aggregates in a certain kind of way. Bodies, perceptions, consciousness. They're just constantly shifting. Based on conditions. Well, and let me just say one more important thing kind of connected with that is it's only by our very cultivating awareness of what this present is about, what's presently going on for us, that's how we change ourselves. That's how we, because things are just arising constantly. However, there are really strong patterns in our lives that we're conditioned. You know, we from the time we're babies onward, you know, we learn ways, strategies to cope, and we develop very strong patterns in our mind by how which we navigate through this world. And they're strong. Those patterns are strong. Strongly developed. At a certain point in time, though, we start to question those patterns. We say, wait a minute, you know, maybe there's another way than just this way I've created things myself. Because there's something not satisfactory about it at the bottom of our lives. Usually that comes, can come, maybe if we've had some great event of suffering in our life. And we see all the patterns by which we've formulated to navigate, they're not working. And those don't work anymore.
Hmm? So you call that consciousness then?
Well, it
you
could
know,
be.
Because I know what you're talking about. You know, mm-hmm. it's like yeah. shock, or, mm-hmm. you know, and you really are very different.
Yeah.
So, what is that?
If not oh, I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, even a dream can shake you like that.
Yeah.
Some kind of phenomena, whatever you want to call it. Where does it come from?
Yeah.
It's, you know, it has that same effect.
Yeah. It's like when we have someone who we love or very close to in a certain kind of way. Well, we always know we could lose that person. You know, it's part of our consciousness. Say a mom and her baby or something, you know, she always knows she could lose the baby or the child. It's there in your consciousness. But until there's the actual loss, until mm-hmm. it's gone.
Experience.
You know, it was just an idea in your consciousness.
Yeah.
Because that changes your whole life. And it's the same with anyone who we love and we lose. You know, we can imagine they'll be gone. And we're saying, well, I better be careful, you know. Gotta have to, you know, keep this thing in perspective, you know. But when they're gone, it's just like everything you thought doesn't matter about it. You know, it just completely redoes the whole insides from the inside out.
I was thinking when you were talking about continuity of self, about how nature, do you know how the seasons, do you know mm-hmm. That pattern of mm-hmm. and how night comes in and day comes in,
mm-hmm.
and you know it sort of keeps us in this that I'm here,
yeah.
and the world is going on. Although it's interesting with climate change, because now patterns that we've gotten used to for centuries are now mm-hmm. being very disruptive. I mm-hmm. mean, hurricanes and mm-hmm. forests that were always there, and you know everything is different now.
Yeah.
I mean, not necessarily for us so much here in the Midwest, but mm-hmm. in other parts of the world. So it really is
yeah.
an interruption
yeah.
of a pattern that we're used to.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the more astute our study is, we can see it. Where I am at Hokkyoji, 13 years ago when I moved there, it was impossible to sleep in the summer in June, early May. It was impossible to sleep past 5 o'clock. You even if you wanted to. Because the birds were just like a jungle. Yeah. Like a jungle. And it's like, I mean, whoa! Be quiet! and I know it's not that, you know, I've adapted, but we did have our ornithologist come visit us, you know, a few. And things changed after a number of years. It wasn't that way. And, you know, I told him about that, and he said, things are changing where these birds migrate to. Not on the other end, in South America and Central America. It's like things are really changing very, very rapidly, right, in that area. And because it's changing there, it's affecting things in where I live, in Minnesota. Yeah. So, there you have it.
You know, there's also that wonderful, this was in the New Yorker so many years ago, but it's about the guy that walks out of a building and there's a manhole cover, you know, open.
Oh,
and he steps in and... The next piece is like he's all damaged and and then there's like five things, and then the next time he steps in only half of them, and then the next one it's just a little bit, but little, and then the last one is that he goes the other way
down another street,
and it's so great in terms of like what you were saying, you know, how we
it takes a long
time. We make
time,
choices and we can. Say, I'm not going to do that again. You know, we can make an internal pattern change. But it's not easy.
No. We just had a memorial for Katagiri Roshi, our teacher, founder of Okeji. And one of the lines that was part of what we said was, sometimes it takes thunder and lightning to awaken us. Not just, wow, what a beautiful tree. It's like, well, you gotta get really speared in the heart before you can, you know, kind of say, I think I need to change some things. Anything else?
Mm-hmm. I wonder, I'm thinking about continuity and change and stuff and lifetime, and thinking about how, thought of clothing and how when we're little infants we wear certain clothes and we wear them for a while and there's some continuity and then we grow out of them. We have to change and deal with the fact that we can't wear that anymore if we liked it or didn't. We fit in spaces, you know, you sort of fit in spaces that don't fit anymore. And so children kind of go through changes, and as children we practice, we have a lot of practice dealing with change. Mm-hmm. At some point, and I'm wondering exactly when this might happen, we become conscious of the changing, and then we know we're changing, maybe that's adolescence. But anyway, we hit this plateau of adulthood. And as represented by our clothing, we could wear them over and over for a long time while we're on this plateau. Mm-hmm. Until we get older, we've browned long enough, they don't fit so well anymore, they've worn out, and we have to change. But the amount of time that we are aware of the changing hits somewhere in our youth. And I wonder if we go through a lot of that plateau of adulthood where we function, most of us, unless something happens, we get a disease or a process or an injury or something that slaps us and wakes us to a different thing. At some point, the aging situation, like you were saying, makes it impossible for you to go to Thailand and carry your entire kit and caboodle and go out in the woods for a long time. the importance of the change in childhood is obvious as we're growing into that adulthood phase. The importance of the change as we get older, I wonder if it isn't a complementary thing and just as preparatory as, in a way, as it was coming up through childhood, through the various phases.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, from the time we're babies to late adolescence, you know, we don't have a choice about this changing. It's just, you know, happening. It's happening so fast we don't even know what's happening. Really, I mean, if you think back on our adolescence, and we might have had an idea about what was happening, but that wasn't it. It was just the bodies changing so fast, and you know, yeah, we're just at a loss almost. You know, we're just hoping, you know, you had some kind of stable place, your home, you know, that you could just kind of hold it barely together. So we go along, but then, you know, at a certain time when we're adults, yeah, we I think there's a natural thing where we want to kind of keep things as they are.
Yeah.
For, you know, we kind of hope, okay, that's enough change. Gone through it.
Yep.
Did it all. Now we're just going to settle down and let's just keep it the way it is. And we may not, and you know, and we all have different conditions by which those things are operating. Sometimes it might be sooner or later when something happens that just says, well, we realize there's a certain way we were brought up to understand the world, to navigate through it. And then we start to question, though, is that really the full understanding of everything that I need to know about? Now, as an adult, you can ask yourself, I have a certain conditions called dokkai, and they go this way on automatic, you know. Says, well, I'm wondering, maybe we should try a different gear or something. So, and usually those changes, in my experience, they usually come about from some kind of suffering we experience, you know, like, in some way or another.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that people are, like, preconceived or born with a certain way or a certain thought process, or do you think that evolves over time? Because I've always wondered, you know, why I think the way I do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's like I've always kind of bounced between like, you know, that all the, I always looked at all the religions and tried to just look at every aspect. And I've always found myself, you know, talking to my friends or just even family members, like, you know, I not to say that I'm right, but I think I always thought, like, hey, I think you should think this way,
mm-hmm.
because it just feels right.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, what you were saying before with, like, just how the past is the past and, you know, the future is, it hasn't yet happened. Like,
mm-hmm.
I wrote a quote years ago that says, like, don't dwell on the past, for it will disrupt the future.
Mm-hmm.
And don't dwell on the future, for it will disrupt the present.
Mm-hmm.
For the past is in the past, and the future hasn't yet happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just always thought that way. So
mm-hmm.
it's like, do you think I just, you know, was I just meant to be into this? Or, like, did I grow those feelings? Or, like, was I born with that
yeah.
thought process? Or
well, I think what we have a certain set of conditions in our life. And they're vast. We couldn't possibly describe them. Some of them, you know, some of them go back to just evolving as human beings, you know, for our survival. We all have that in us as a species. So there's biological conditions and every other kind of condition. Some of it's way before we were even born.
Mm-hmm.
We're born into the human condition. Some of it's you know, our parental situation and our social environment, and some of it's just, you know, the genetic thing, specifically with our parents. So they're just vast.
I think it is mostly situations, you know, that mm-hmm. make me think, like, you know, life is short, and mm-hmm. every day is its own day. And mm-hmm. I always just gave myself that self-awareness you're talking mm-hmm. about. I was always to take a step back. I'm always able to take a step back and be like, mm-hmm. you know, this is important or it's not important, or, you know, neither. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I just always thought it was a good way to
think. And sometimes the conditions are just exactly the choices we've made, you know,
yeah, right.
one by one, all through our life.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of it too. You know, it's not like fate. You know, we're just going along here, and we don't have any control over anything
right.
because we're conditioned from the past. And it's not like we can do anything we want.
Right.
It's neither one, because there's limitations. Both physically and even in my own mind. You know, there's things I can't change even in my own mind. I can't be a lot smarter than I am. There's just things, we can't change, but the things we are can.
Mm-hmm. It is fascinating, though, how it can happen. Like, I used to live along the lake, and every day I walked along the lake. And it was just background for me. I didn't have any relationship out of feeling or, you know, it was just, and then I got a dog. I adopted a dog from mm-hmm. the Humane Society, you know, one of those throwaways.
Mm-hmm.
And he was madly in love with this water. Mm-hmm. I mean, just wildly alive mm-hmm. when he would see the water and we would walk. And little by little, and you know, to me, a dog was just a dog. It was mm-hmm. like a dog, you know, it's kind of like mm-hmm. the lake.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a four-legged being, but I didn't have a connection.
Mm-hmm.
And little by little, something began to happen. I began to awaken to the sky and the water and this four-legged animal,
mm-hmm.
and it completely changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
It was really an amazing experience for mm-hmm. me. And it stays like one of the most important times. I mean, mm-hmm. I woke up to nature. I woke up to this living earth and this living sky and all the things that I'm ensconced in. And I never, before it was just, there.
Mm-hmm. That to me it seems like, you know, that just life is funny that way. That dog was put into your possession for a reason, to make you think that way, you know?
I love that.
Yeah.
And you never know.
Well, I'd like to close now. My legs are sore.